Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, December 3rd, 2025, we're delighted to host a discussion on FTC versus Meta, Requiem for the War on Tech. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator, and then I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Ashish Agarwal, who currently serves as a consultant for the American Edge Project and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Before stepping into those roles, he has served in senior roles at the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission. At the FTC, Ashish served as Assistant Director of the Office of Policy Planning, where he led initiatives to help consumers and examine barriers to the growth of e-commerce. And as I said, I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. A last note before I get off your screens. If you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Ms. Ashish, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Kayla. Thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this, as well as to the Antitrust and Consumer Protection Executive Committee and our chair, Svetlana Gans, for support in all of our programming. Well, as folks know, in 2020, the FTC sued Meta over its acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp. The FTC alleged that Meta sought to eliminate threats to its social networking monopoly and that ultimately harmed consumers through increased user ad loads and decreased privacy. After a six-week trial, last month, the district court ruled in favor of Meta and found that the company competed in a broader market of social media rather than a narrow market of social networking. Today, we have an outstanding panel to discuss the case and its import for the future. We have Bilal Saeed, who is in private practice at Cadwalader, an adjunct professor at the Scalia Law School, and the host of an entertaining antitrust podcast called Rethinking Antitrust. In President Trump's first term, Bilal led the FTC's Office of Policy Planning and was at the FTC when the Meta case was filed. We also have Jennifer Huddleston, who is a senior fellow in technology policy at the Cato Institute. Her research focuses on the intersection of emerging technology, law, and the administrative state. And finally, we have Daniel Suhr, who serves as president of the Center for American Rights, where he promotes free speech, free enterprise, and parental freedom in education. Dan formerly worked as policy director for former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. All right, let's start with the core legal issues, and we'll branch out a little bit and talk about kind of policy and the broader implications. So, Bilal, for people who maybe haven't had a chance to read the decision yet, can you provide a brief summary?
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought in some sense you provided the brief summary because, in a sense, the conclusion was quite brief. So, look, the FTC had alleged. I'll cover a little bit of ground you already covered. The FTC had alleged in its initial complaint and in its amended complaint that Meta had engaged in a systematic strategy, including through acquisitions and some conduct, to maintain its monopoly position in a market for personal social networking, right? And at the time, in its complaints, the FTC defined the market to include relatively small number of competitors, in particular excluding firms that today appear to operate in a similar, if not the same, type of market, TikTok and YouTube. So what was the issue for the court? The issue for the court was, at least first, to define the relevant market and then to identify whether Meta had monopoly power in that market. Now, the court, to my mind, seemed to accept some version of the FTC's market definition, but broadened it a bit to take account of both changes to Meta's products, including changes to Instagram, as well as what I'd call the entry or expansion of participants in a market that was sort of broader than personal social networking, right? And that's YouTube and TikTok. Now, what I think is sort of interesting for the analysis of the case is because of the way the FTC filed the case, the court believed that whatever the merits of the FTC's position, you know, either at the time it filed its complaint in 2020 or its amended complaint in 2021, or at the time of the acquisitions and the conduct that the complaints alleged were harmful, the court would look at the question of market definition and monopoly power at the current stage or currently, right? And so the case seemed to sort of turn on this time dimension of the analysis, right? Basically, to quote the last line, whether or not Meta enjoyed monopoly power in the past, the agency must show that it continues to hold such power now. And the court's verdict determines that the FTC has not done so. And it gets to that conclusion, and I don't want to jump over what anyone else will say, it gets to that conclusion by looking at both changes in the market, changes in consumers' behavior, changes in how consumers react to disruptions in the market, to both define, you know, something broader than personal social networking, and to include other, as I said, YouTube and in particular TikTok in that relevant market. So, Ashish, maybe that gets us to where we're supposed to get.
Okay, well, that's a great start, Bilal. Jennifer, so as Bilal says, the court's decision really did hinge on this notion that, you know, markets have evolved over time, and even if maybe Meta had a monopoly at some point in the past, you know, it no longer does so. What do you think about the court's analysis of market definition, and what do you think the opinion means for other antitrust cases?
Thank you, Ashish, and thank you for putting together this panel to both you and the folks at FedSoc, and thank you, Bilal, for that kind of excellent overview to get us started. As you mentioned, a lot of this case really hinged on market definition, particularly what the market Facebook competes in. And this has been an issue in a lot of the debates over antitrust in the tech sector. The FTC was seeking to come up with a very narrow definition, as Bilal mentioned, one that largely excluded things like TikTok, like YouTube, that particularly when considering a product like Instagram Reels, many consumers are already engaging in multi-homing. They may go to certain platforms for certain creators or certain types of content. They're already kind of naturally seeing in their own lives, if you were to ask the average consumer, you know, what is a short form video platform? You might get the answer Instagram, you might get Facebook Shorts, or you might get one of these other platforms. Similarly, around questions when it comes to WhatsApp and private messaging, while WhatsApp provides one encrypted private messaging service, there have been a growing number of these platforms, many of which have become well-known in their own right, whether it's Telegram or any other Signal or any other number of existing services, not to mention all the other ways that an average individual may choose to communicate with one another. But beyond that, there was also this question about the fact of what did we know about these markets at the time that these acquisitions occurred, and what, if anything, should the court take into account in that regard? Was this the kind of case of the what has been called the kill zone in the technology sector, where a large platform has sought to acquire or otherwise crush an emerging competitor before it could really challenge things? And one of the things that the court really highlights in this is that we can't know and we can't make presumptions based on a counterfactual. We don't know how the market might have evolved in a world where Facebook never acquired Instagram or where Facebook never acquired WhatsApp. And we shouldn't make presumptions about how those things would would evolve. 10 years on, 15 years on, we don't necessarily know what those separate platforms would look like. They might have become additional competitors in some of those markets, or they might have not been able to survive because there are certain advantages of having platforms that have broader resources. Not to mention that at the time of these acquisitions, they certainly weren't sure things. We certainly didn't see this idea that these were automatically going to be these huge successful acquisitions until afterwards when we saw how these tools came together. So I think one of the other key things around market definition was that was when were we seeing that market definition take place, where the court was really looking, wasn't trying to kind of create this counterfactual world as it seemed like the FTC wanted it to consider.
So, Dan, we've talked a lot about market definition, but the court largely, you know, ignored or minimized the FTC's concerns about, you know, the competition has decreased due to increased user ad loads, that, you know, Meta, then Facebook, you know, acquired Instagram and WhatsApp, you know, arguably to, you know, remove rivals from the playing field, and that, you know, Meta was by some metrics earning very, very high profits, and that shows they have monopoly power. What do you think of the court's analysis?
Yeah, I was in many ways pleased and in many ways displeased with the way the court approached this. These are obviously complicated issues, and I think they call for a lot of nuance. And that seemed sometimes to be missing from the court's opinion. One tough reality, I think, here, I almost felt bad for the commission as I was reading the opinion, that it seemed like the goalposts kept moving, that at each of the critical junctures in the case, the court would sort of shift the goalposts for the commission, and, you know, appropriately, I think, underlined that it was the commission's burden to prove these things, and yet continued to sort of change based on evolving markets how things are being judged. And so you almost come away from the opinion with a sense of sympathy for the commission, and further, I think, frustration from the commission that's very understandable, that their, I think, core premise, really what Bilal started us with, that Facebook made these decisions with an intention of being anti-competitive. The court really doesn't engage with that, I think, in a serious way. It sort of blows by what sort of would have motivated Facebook at the time to acquire these alternative apps, and does so stripped of context, right? As Jennifer mentioned, we see this pattern of behavior in a lot of other parts of the tech sector, where large incumbent market players buy up smaller potential competitors. This is a consistent pattern that we've seen with big tech players, and the court never really appreciates, I think, that context, that pattern of behavior in this overall sector, and approaches what Facebook was doing here with a appropriate skepticism as to its motives.
Well, you know, the timeliness and the of the litigation really factored in to the decision. What does the case say about the timeliness of antitrust litigation? I mean, do we need to find, you know, a way to speed up the process so it's a little more responsive to markets? Or should we just say, you know what, markets evolve, that's what the court found, so there's really not much of a problem here from a consumer standpoint?
Well, I think you can take both positions, right? I mean, I think one useful fix, so-called fix to antitrust law, would not be substantive changes to antitrust law, but some measures with respect to some adjustment measures, and maybe it occurs at the court level, to speeding up trials, right? I mean, in this one, the case was filed in December 2020. It went to trial in, you know, the spring of 2025 after two motion to dismiss opinions and one summary judgment motion. That's just going to harm, you know, your case sort of naturally if you're asking whether someone has monopoly power now. But I do want to say is, you know, the acquisitions by Facebook or Meta, and the development of the market over time is sort of consistent with the idea that these acquisitions of small firms are intended not to maintain monopoly power in a static sense, but to develop the market in a dynamic sense, right? I mean, the court, I think, gets it absolutely right when it says something like, the court can't believe that, you know, consumers or whatever the right word is, you know, would prefer the Instagram and WhatsApp of, you know, 2012 and 2014 to the versions that exist now. Right. So antitrust cases ought to be quicker, but we also ought to recognize that one of the defenses of parties, particularly parties who are acquiring a lot of firms, is that it is not necessarily to build moats around a relevant market or build moats around competition, but actually to respond to pressures in the market to improve products, right, and distribute new products. So, yeah, I'd love to see faster trials, but I think this case is, in fact, the poster child for the defenses that many acquiring companies make, which is products are not always developed in-house or improved in-house. They're improved and developed through acquisition.
Jennifer, Dan, do you have a reaction to Bilal's point that this case is a poster child for acquiring companies?
So in some ways, as a reaction to both Bilal's point and to something that Daniel said, too, because personally, I think this case illustrates how much of a myth this idea of a kill zone is, that companies are often acquiring companies for a variety of reasons that might not always be obvious at the particular time. What we ideally want to see in the tech merger and acquisition sector is something that has a wide variety of exit strategies. You know, Facebook turned down its own offer at one point to get acquired, and since grew into a very globally competitive platform. In other cases, it may be the better decision for a company to get acquired. Maybe an entrepreneur wants to keep being an entrepreneur. They don't want to run a large business. Maybe there are certain elements of a business that could benefit from being integrated into a larger product and reaching more consumers that way, or creating certain solutions for various teams, the kind of idea of acqui-hiring there. There may be other businesses that want to stay small, that they have a very niche product and they think that it's important that they're able to serve that niche customer. And then there also may be those cases which we should applaud where companies do choose to IPO. But an IPO is not a sure thing, and it's a long and difficult road, and there are many regulatory barriers to clear on that side as well. So it's not always as clear cut as it may be. But I do think this case also, though, sends a strong message around mergers and acquisitions more generally and how they will be looked at in the antitrust sector. Because one of the concerns had certainly been, if this went forward, this was such a retroactive kind of review. We were looking at decisions that had been settled for many years. What could that mean in other cases where it seemed like an acquisition had long been settled? And what would that mean not only in the tech sector, but in other areas of industry as well?
And I will have your thoughts on all of that. And let me throw in an additional question based on what Jennifer just said, which is that, you know, I know that a real concern of the business community was this, timeliness, factor. The acquisitions happened, I believe, 2014, 2015. And so you're talking about potentially a decade later unwinding these acquisitions. What do you think the case said? And the court's opinion didn't really touch on that factor much at all. But do you think the opinion, what does the opinion say, if anything, about kind of the stability and predictability of the merger review process? And then welcome your thoughts on, Jennifer and Bilal's broader points.
Sure. So on the merger review process, I think the consistent theme is that we want reviews that are both thorough and timely, right? And those things may seem like they're in tension, obviously these are very fact-intensive and expertise-intensive areas, right? We saw in the case this kind of dueling battle of experts trying to define the different markets. We saw lots of survey data about how users interact with these different apps, about the types of ads that they want. Right. So there's a fact intensity that is real. And at the same time, I think Bilal is absolutely correct that we want prompt regulatory review that for mergers and acquisitions to go forward. That's something that customers deserve. So that's a hard balance to strike. I think it's really incumbent on policymakers to prioritize where we see problems in markets and to spend more time maybe on those areas. And I think big tech is one of those areas, right? Maybe another way of saying something along the lines of Jennifer's comments is it's been really encouraging to hear us talk about little tech at the same time we talk about big tech, that over the course of the past couple of years, we've seen a renewed focus and appreciation on the part of policymakers for the importance of having space for entrepreneurs and new market entrants. And yet the reality is that big tech seems to just keep getting bigger, and that the little tech companies often feel crushed down by the competition. Part of that is natural, right? One of the things that is true of platforms like Facebook is that you want to reach as many people as possible because you want to have as many friends as possible, right? Or as many people interacting in the system, and that builds on itself. But there are also times where I think these companies do engage in anti-competitive acquisitions or hiring. And those are the places like here where it's appropriate for the FTC to step in and protect consumers.
Well, Dan, let's put a pin in that for just a few moments. We do want to get back to this point about what the case means for kind of this broader issue about, you know, big tech and little tech and the president's agenda. But just a couple more questions about the opinion itself. Bilal, you know, the court took pains to question the impartiality of the FTC's primary expert witness on the grounds that the expert had really advocated for the case to be brought in the first place. Was that fair of the court? And, you know, does opinion offer any kind of caution for, you know, people in the antitrust field who might want to serve as experts, but who have strong opinions about an enforcement matter? You're muted, Bob.
I think the court, at least, you know, in reading the opinion, it sort of reads as if he's, if Judge Boasberg is quite critical and sort of challenging the credibility of, you know, the expert Scott Hempel. And look, I think it was a problem to use as an expert somebody who had, as the district court notes, come into the FTC, you know, 7 years earlier, and sort of suggest that the FTC ought to be looking at Facebook and considering a monopolization case. You know, I think that's sort of a lesson for the FTC not to, you know, set itself, you know, put, you know, sort of one strike against it by picking someone who appears to have some investment, about, you know, let's say personal or investment or professional investment in the case. But I think the court was a little bit careless, maybe in suggesting, implying that the expert, that Scott Hempel's opinions were biased because of that interest in the case, interest in antitrust. So, you know, an agency ought to be more careful not to set itself up for this. But I don't think that the court identifies some, you know, some difficulties or differences with Scott's opinion, but I think it's unfair to suggest that those differences are related to sort of a preconceived bias in what became the conclusions.
Jennifer, Dan, any reactions there? Okay.
Yeah, I would just totally agree. Again, I feel like this is one of the places where the court is moving the goalposts on the agency. Like, we shouldn't be surprised that expert witnesses come to cases with opinions. That's what they're brought in for in the first place. And I felt like the court was very unfair to the agency in sort of expecting that the expert opinion wouldn't have an opinion beforehand, right? Like, it seemed like he came into the agency with this opinion based on his academic research and experience in this sector. And we shouldn't be surprised that he carried it through. And if the agency has a relationship with someone who they like and trust, who seems like an expert, they're going to hire him as an expert. We as lawyers do this all the time. I think it'd be quite a challenge if we were to go through, you know, redistricting cases or voter ID cases and say to the sides, like, well, you can't hire an academic who has any, you know, preconceived notions about these things. This is just what we hire experts for. And it felt really unfair on the court's part.
Well, Dan, that leads nicely into the next question that I have for you. You know, after the decision came down, the FTC pointed out that the district court judge, James Boasberg, has had articles of impeachment filed against him. For people who haven't played close attention, what are the allegations against Judge Boasberg, and how, if at all, might, you know, those allegations and some of the kind of the surrounding noise around him factor at all into how an appellate court might look at the case? If there is an appeal, we don't know that yet. And the kind of the willingness of, say, other policymakers to sort of accept the decision as the right one.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a lot of conversation as a country in the past few months about the incredibly aggressive exercise of judicial power on the part of some federal district court judges during the first year of the Trump administration. And I would say example A for judges who have been targeted in the media and otherwise for criticism because of just really aggressive uses of judicial power, Judge Boasberg would be at the top of that list. And in particular, as you know, he is now subject to articles of impeachment, which is really extraordinary. It's incredibly rare that we would even see articles introduced against a member of Article III because of his role in Arctic Frost, that he is the judge who was responsible for overseeing the Arctic Frost investigation, and in particular, the investigation that included various Republican elected officials, members of Congress, who were subject to government surveillance based on his approval. And so there is, I think, a deep distrust of Judge Boasberg among certainly Republican policymakers right now, Republican pundits and members of the media. Ultimately, this opinion is going to have to stand on its own two feet. It's long, it's thorough. It'll be ready for appellate review if and when it comes. But certainly it'll be the case then in the surrounding policy conversation, I think the impact of the opinion will be limited because of the skepticism that a lot of members of Congress and opinion leaders have as soon as they hear who wrote it.
Jennifer Bilal, any reaction to that? All right. Well, Jennifer, I know that a lot of your work focuses on, speech issues. And while the case was not about, speech and some of the issues that have been surrounding social media, Chairman Ferguson said as much explicitly, how might this decision interact with other ongoing FTC actions involving Meta and other social media companies, including the FTC's request for information on censorship?
Yeah, I think in many ways that's the next question. There does seem to still be some animosity towards Meta as well as towards certain other tech companies. Are we going to perhaps see policymakers try and use other tools to go after these companies due to particular issues that they may have with certain actions? Particularly, we've seen a lot of kind of saber rattling, for lack of a better term, around questions of content moderation. So as you mentioned in your question, there's this request for information on big tech censorship, where the FTC was seeking to gather examples of where individuals felt that their content had been wrongly taken down or limited or otherwise removed from leading social media platforms. There also at times have been comments indicating that the FTC may be thinking about how this could play out with regards to even potential antitrust claims around content moderation actions. But I think it's very important to remember that antitrust policy and competition policy is designed to deal with antitrust and competition issues. It's not designed to be some sort of panacea for other policy concerns that might arise. And regardless of whether or not one feels that those policy concerns are things that do or do not need intervention, using antitrust to go after other policy concerns is unlikely to end up either good for antitrust or good for those policy concerns. So if we take, for example, content moderation, if you have, say, a separate Instagram and a separate Facebook, there's no guarantee that they would moderate any differently from each other if they're still trying to serve the same general purpose audience. And in fact, there are concerns that smaller platforms might not be able to have access to some of the state-of-the-art tools that keep these general purpose platforms the type of places that many people want to be. And I'm not talking about gray areas where we may disagree about what should or shouldn't be allowed, but I'm talking about things like spam filters or like some of the more heinous content that none of us want to see in our kind of daily social media scroll feeds. Additionally, allowing antitrust to move away from its objective and economically sound purpose risk having it what is already a very powerful tool being able to be used even more subjectively by the government to go after any array of concerns that it may have without kind of those guardrails to ensure that it is only used when there isn't another solution, and perhaps even and that allowing the government to use it for these other policy solutions would allow the government to intervene in markets far more broadly and far more generally.
Bilal, you were at the FTC when this case was filed. Any comments there? And Dan, I know a lot of your work focuses on speech issues. Would love your thoughts on this one too. Bilal, I'll start with you.
So simple response, which is, you know, over the last five or so years, starting with the Biden administration and frankly, maybe including the first Trump administration, the FTC is losing a lot of its what I call non-standard antitrust cases, ones that attempt to push the envelope, you know, a little bit more aggressively with respect to application of the antitrust laws. And I think it's possible in many cases an example of that. So that ought to be sort of a fair warning that they ought not to expand their antitrust toolbox into other areas, right? They're not, they are not successfully doing it within, you know, sort of antitrust cases. Think of Microsoft Activision, think of the Meta Within case, maybe think of Qualcomm, you know, and a few others. So it would just be folly, I think, bad management of the agency to expand into other areas when they are losing at their core, at sort of their core mission of slowly expanding or rationalizing antitrust law.
Dan?
Yeah, I think there is a overlap between speech and antitrust, and it's when these platforms operate as the public square, and then they're the only option for the public square, right? That's simply to say, if, for instance, Facebook and X were, for a certain period of time, the two primary platforms where people could express views about policy issues, like everyday people expressing views to other everyday people, right? If that was a market that we could define, platforms for expressing views on policy, well, if there are only two players and both of those players shut down conversation around a particular topic, COVID, or whatever else it might be, January 6th, when those limited number of platforms shut down conversation on a topic, it really affects our democratic discourse as a country overall. So I do think there's a very justified intersection between free speech concerns and antitrust concerns when we have this limited number of platforms where people are speaking up. When that speech is then shut down, I think it creates a real problem. And I think we may have lost our moderator.
So without the moderator, Daniel, let me ask you a question. You know, first, how do you sort of address sort of the potential First Amendment issues associated with the way you've articulated the issue? You know, too few platforms. We'd like to see them, in a sense, either more platforms or the existing platforms publish more. You know, I think that's a core issue for the agency, which is on the content moderation question, censorship question, whatever you want to talk about. You know, can they get around the First Amendment issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would actually break that down into maybe two buckets. One is the First Amendment, and the other is Section 230. Because I would say on the First Amendment, obviously there's the Miami Herald versus Tornillo case, which I think appropriately recognizes that publishers retain the right to determine what they publish, right? And that's totally appropriate. If a newspaper wants to reject a letter to the editor, it can. And similarly, if a social media platform wants to reject a particular viewpoint, it can. I'm not sure that's the same as the Section 230 argument. I have some sympathy for Professor Volokh's view. I think he's probably right that the in good faith standard that's incorporated in a Section 230 includes some viewpoint neutrality principle. But maybe that's a separate debate. Either way, though, I think from the FTC's perspective, though the companies do have those First Amendment rights that we need to respect under the Miami Herald holding, if there are only two companies and they both act in the same way, that really affects consumers. And again, when it's a very constrained market with very few platforms offering a particular service, like being a forum, that creates problems for consumers that appropriately draw the agency's attention.
Before we hand it back over to Ashish, I'd also kind of like to respond to a few things, Bilal, from what you just said to Dan. First off, I think it's underappreciated oftentimes how pro-competitive of a law Section 230 is. But Section 230 is particularly critical to those small and mid-sized platforms, to those platforms that are trying to gain a foot in the door, who are trying to perhaps serve a specific audience or a new audience that they feel is currently underserved, because it helps ensure that if someone uses your platform for something you never intended it to be used for, that your first hire, your second hire doesn't have to be an attorney. Maybe it should be. I know we're on a FedSoc call, but that you can focus on developing the platform, developing the community as you see fit, and that you can provide the opportunities for perhaps audiences that you feel like were not currently able to have the space that you saw as an opportunity for the market. And I think oftentimes, while I do feel that these should be considered two very separate issue, the way that Section 230 actually encourages competition, encourages and enables smaller players to offer user-generated content is an underappreciated aspect of the law. Second, I think some of the conversations around whether or not certain viewpoints or certain topics have been allowed on social media platforms, particularly at heightened flashpoints, whether it was COVID or other topics, also intersect with conversations around job owning, and that it's important that we keep separate questions of private content moderation decisions and of the government pressure that might be violating the First Amendment. I think that's another conversation that whenever we're talking about online speech we need to make clear, are we talking about an individual platform saying they don't want to carry a certain type of content, or are we talking about the government going to a platform and saying, nice platform you've got there, would be a shame if anything were to happen to it. Have you seen this post over here, by the way? Type of situation. And then I do think that the market around social media in general has shifted since 2020. And we've seen entrance of new platforms with a variety of particularly political viewpoints represented there. So you have things like Truth Social now that have come out since there. You've had pretty significant changes at what was Twitter is now X since its ownership by Elon Musk. But you've also had other platforms emerge that are trying different types of content moderation and serving different audiences. So I'm thinking about things like Blue Sky and Discord that have very decentralized methods and perhaps are serving audiences that are dissatisfied with some of the changes they've seen at places like Twitter.
All right. Well, thanks all. So let's now step back and look at the big picture. So the title of this panel was, is this the Requiem for the War on Tech? Bilal, let's start with you. So by my count, we have the antitrust agencies losing challenges to Microsoft, Activision, Meta within, now Instagram, WhatsApp, two wins against Google, but at least fairly modest relief so far. And the cases against Amazon and Apple are in early stages. So what do we say about the status of what we'll call the war on tech?
Look, I think the so-called war on tech is likely to continue. The Google cases are not resolved. We don't know what they're going to do with Facebook. And of course, I think Apple and Amazon either will go to trial or likely will settle. I don't think the agencies are going to sort of dismiss those cases. If I were thinking about this from the FTC or DOJ perspective, I would not think about abandoning cases in the tech space because tech is important and we want competitive markets in the tech space. But I would think hard about whether I'm bringing the cases in the right way, whether I'm bringing narrow enough claims so I can get relief quickly and also defend those claims. And also think harder about whether litigation is necessary to address the harms and maybe propose or accept settlements that are supportive of, you know, really the entry question and not go into cases thinking what the right remedy is going to be a breakup, right? I mean, that seems to be where the two Google cases, you know, were filed under the impression that they were going to go for a breakup. The Meta or Facebook or Meta case here was filed, you know, with a request for relief that would probably thought that, you know, one or two of the large acquisitions would have to be spun off. I think they're overreaching in an area where the agencies ought to be active because it's an important area of the economy. So they just got to be smarter. They shouldn't stop enforcement.
Well, of note, DOJ did not object to Google's acquisition of Wiz, which is a fairly significant acquisition. Dan, so what are your thoughts on kind of the status of the so-called war on tech? And let me also throw in there, you know, what does the case say about how does the case fit into the Trump administration's, you know, America First antitrust agenda? And what does it mean for kind of the future of antitrust enforcement in this administration?
Yeah, I think this administration is going to continue full speed ahead. Commissioner Mark Meador had a really important piece, I think, in American Affairs just a few weeks ago, sort of laying out a new conservative vision for antitrust. If you haven't read it, I really would recommend it to you. But he goes through in a pretty thoughtful, detailed way how he thinks about antitrust. And that sort of sentiment is one I think you see from Chairman Ferguson, that you see from the leadership at the DOJ antitrust division, that similarly, when you read some of the recent speeches by Gail Slater at Notre Dame or at Drake, she has a vision for where she wants to take this, that America First antitrust is broader than just big tech. Recently at Drake, she talked about agriculture as an application of this kind of new philosophy. But tech has always been at the heart of the America First antitrust agenda. I think you can see that all the way back to when Gail Slater was announced in President Trump's Truth Social, putting a focus on the problems with big tech. So I expect it will continue, and I applaud him for doing it.
Jennifer, your thoughts?
So I want to pick up on some of what both Bilal and Dan have said. As was mentioned, there are ongoing cases, and while I think there are a lot of concerns about various elements of those particular cases as well, I'm sure we'll have future webinars with some of us discussing some of those cases as well. It doesn't seem like the recent loss is likely to lead to those cases being abandoned. One of the things that we didn't discuss in this webinar, because it's a separate case, that I do think is worth noting is how dynamic this industry is, particularly in the AI moment. I did see that we had an audience question come in about AI. And when you think about, for example, the Google case, which was, you know, one of those cases where you might have initially thought this is a win, when you look at the decision and the remedies, not only did the court reject the more radical remedies, but in his decision, in his remedies decision, Judge Meta, not to be confused with the Meta case, mentions how quickly AI has moved, kind of calling into question his own previous decision about whether or not AI was already disrupting that market. So as these cases, as Bilal mentioned earlier in this webinar, continue to take significant periods of time, I think there is a real question of what will these markets look like by the time we're at trial or by the time we're at any kind of decisions in these cases, given the rapid pace of innovation. But I think there's also a question that is often unasked, which is, what are we perhaps missing out on while these cases are going on? When we think about, for example, something like the Microsoft case, there's been statements made since then that part of why Microsoft was late to mobile or didn't launch in mobile was because there were resources and concerns tied to the antitrust case. What, whether it's something related to AI or some other product, might we find out that some of our leading tech companies weren't able to compete in or felt that they couldn't compete in because their time and resources were dedicated to antitrust? And there is a bit of a kind of warning story from Europe about what a more aggressive antitrust approach could mean on that front, that we do see some of America's leading tech companies choosing not to launch certain products in Europe because of a more competitor rather than consumer focused standard that is and a standard that makes it where they have concerns about being able to enter new aspects of the market or launch new products over there. And who ultimately loses out in such cases are the consumers.
So I want to build off something that you just said, Jennifer, and Bilal and Dan, maybe challenge something that you guys have just said. You know, the question is going to be, you know, is there a little bit of a disconnect between the president, at least some of his public statements, and the antitrust agencies? So you do hear, you know, the president talking about how, you know, we need you know, great American companies to win the race, you know, in AI, you know, against China. You know, the administration has pushed back very hard against European policies and in other countries that, you know, really single out, you know, American tech companies for extra scrutiny. So you have that. On the one hand, you have the president seeming to champion, you know, our largest tech companies and little tech as well. On the other hand, we still don't know. You still have DOJ, you know, very aggressive lawsuits against, you know, against Apple. May still seek an appeal to try to break up Google. We don't know if the FTC is going to, you know, appeal the Meta decision yet. So is there some disconnect there? Bilal, I'll start with you.
So look, if there's a disconnect, it's the same disconnect we've seen, you know, for 100 years. I mean, some of the great antitrust cases, interesting antitrust cases, were against AT&T. And AT&T was probably as significant a player in the, you know, telecom industry and information industry when it was at its heyday than some of these companies are now, right? So I think there's a long history of the U.S. government challenging the activity of what are otherwise viewed as potentially assets on the national security side. So, you know, arguably it's a little inconsistent, but there's a long history of doing it. I think, look, we saw that in the Qualcomm case too, right? So, yes, there's a disconnect, but we've lived with it for 50, 60, 70, 80 years.
Yeah, Dan, welcome your thoughts. And, you know, in your previous comments, you said, look, despite the opinion, it's going to be full speed ahead for a vigorous antitrust agenda. Is that fully consistent with some of the messaging we're hearing from the president?
Yeah, I don't see a disconnect at all. In fact, I think there's a pretty consistent approach, which is we take each of these sub industries within tech as they come, right? I don't think beating China in some sort of war for technology in the future is going to be because we get a better set of ads when we're on Facebook or that we have, you know, chatbots with children, right? That's not going to be what wins the war with China. It's going to be military or industrial applications. It's going to be commercial applications that encourage our economic productivity and efficiency. So I think when the president talks about winning the competitive race with China and really championing U.S. technology, it's seen much more in a economic context for tech that exists in that space, which is different from much more of the social media companies, which frankly, I don't think are important to winning any sort of race with China. If anything, one of the things that we see in Judge Boasberg's opinion is that it essentially took TikTok with the full resources of the Chinese government behind it coming into this market to create a competitor to what Meta was offering. That TikTok was one of the key factors that changed the market and the way the market was defined. But it took, you know, the resources of one of the largest countries in the world behind it in order for that company to come into the market successfully. So I think that says something about this particular case, but at a broader level, I think it's very easy to square what the president said in championing AI and crypto on the one hand, and at the other hand, being skeptical of the social media companies. And that just means taking tech in its individual slices with thoughtful nuance, rather than treating Silicon Valley as one big conglomerate.
Jennifer, any thoughts there? And then we've got time for a couple of audience questions. Go ahead, Jennifer.
You know, I do think that there are global elements to this competition that oftentimes, because we're fortunate that many of the leading companies are American, we forget about that this is a, particularly when it comes to AI, a global competition. And that when we're looking at some of these innovations, when we're looking at things like quantum or AI, that oftentimes they require large investments of capital, which may mean that larger companies are better situated for some of those initial investments. Now, even when we're looking at something like AI, there are many, many companies. It's not just the large players, and it depends on what level of the AI stack you're looking at. Secondly, I would say we shouldn't be so quick to push aside, you know, global competition, even in something like the social media space. How oftentimes one of the great values of the internet has been how it's allowed us to expose our people to different points of view, and also how it's allowed us to gain information of what's going on all around the world. That can also mean opportunities to share the values of a free society, to show, you know, why free speech, why those fundamental values, particularly as we kind of approach the 250th, why the ideas that a free society are built on are the ideas that can lead to lasting prosperity. And so I think providing platforms that allow the free exchange of ideas can certainly be a wonderful opportunity to provide a vision of such values as well. So we shouldn't just think about this in one particular context, nor should we think about a situation where that means that we see the government kind of funneling activity towards only one particular technology. And also to bring up something that was brought up earlier about the kind of new look at little tech, I think we should be careful not to pit big tech and little tech against each other. These are very often symbiotic relationships, and one company may be little one day and big the next, or big one day and then no longer be a part of our everyday discourse. If we'd been having debates about big tech 20 years ago, we would have had a completely different set of companies we would have been talking about than the companies we're talking about today. And who knows which companies in 20 years will be the little tech companies or the big tech companies. And one of the concerns I have with some of the approach we've seen, particularly from the FTC under Lina Khan, but also with this broader neo-Brandeisian approach, is this return of this big is automatically bad mentality, rather than actually looking at the questions at hand when it comes to competition and to whether or not a company is big, is it successful, or because of anti-competitive behavior.
Okay, let's get to a couple of audience questions. Bilal, this one is for you. Should it have mattered that the FTC had previously not objected to Meta's acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp legally? That did not come up meaningfully in the court's decision. Should it have?
So, look, I don't think the court should take account of that. I think the agencies should take account of that when they're thinking of bringing cases around transactions they've previously cleared. But I wouldn't put a bar, let's say, on the agency doing that. In this case, of course, the agency brought the case on a different theory than they would have been able to challenge the two earlier acquisitions that were a core component. But, you know, I think it's a mistake for the courts in particular to say, well, and they did this, sort of did this a little bit in the Google cases, to say, you know, you passed on these acquisitions or transactions before, and I'm uncomfortable with you getting a second bite at the apple. I mean, the agencies rarely do it. They ought to get credit for, in a sense, managing that with discretion. But courts sort of recognize that agencies may get things wrong. Markets may adapt or not adapt in a way that you thought or didn't think they would. So I wouldn't I would encourage the agencies to be to use their discretion, but not preclude them from bringing cases and also sort of not worry about it.
All right. Last question is from the audience. This gets to sort of international comity in antitrust cases. And the question is, if there arises an AI antitrust case, which has cross-border implications, do you think that a court would be reluctant to make a kind of a firm, bright line holding, given that, a foreign court might reach a different outcome? And might that lead to sort of, vaguer, more ambiguous decisions? Whoever wants to take that.
I'll make one comment on that. I think one way to help prevent that type of sort of issue from arising is to allow for close coordination between U.S. and non-U.S. antitrust agencies and other similar agencies, right? Now, of course, that's not going to help at the court level, but I think, there's a real benefit to the FTC talking to the EU and other agencies, DOJ as well. And I think we're in a, at least publicly, there's some real skepticism of the benefits of the agencies doing that. And that's, I think, will harm sensible antitrust over time, sensible antitrust enforcement. And thus that may, impact the way courts think about these cases. So, and of course, we do think about comity questions in, with respect to OPEC, for example, right? One reason we don't sue OPEC is for comity reasons.
We're pretty much at time, but Jennifer and Dan, love to give you 30 seconds, like a presidential moderator. Comment on that and any final thoughts?
I would just say quick, I think the same is true of states, right? One of the things that has been interesting about the antitrust battles with big tech have been the role that state attorneys general have played in many of these cases, where both conservative red state and liberal blue state AGs have come in based on their own state antitrust laws or otherwise in support of the antitrust agencies. I think that speaks to the broad consensus across America in politics that feels like these big tech companies have too much power and that it's the states as much as the feds who are taking a role in pushing back on it.
Jennifer, you get the last word, 30 seconds or less.
With the last word in 30 seconds or less, I'm going to say what is my favorite thought on this issue in general, which is that it's often underappreciated that innovation is, in fact, our best competition policy, that by allowing ourselves to continue to have a leading innovative sector in the market, that we get ideas and products that completely disrupt those markets that we are experiencing right now, such that going back to our original question of market definition, how quickly those markets can change in ways that we might not have ever predicted, let alone the way that a government bureaucrat would be able to predict.
Not nicely done. Thank you all. Kayla, back to you.
I will echo those thanks on behalf of the Federalist Society. Thanks so much to our panel for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking this section of your afternoons and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.